StoryCorps founder David Isay's book, Mom, highlights the stories of people like Jose Cruz.
My mother told me that I was the cutest thing in Villa Juana. And she would give me a big kiss. And I would go to school with this big stamp of red lipstick on my forehead.
This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. David Isay joins us later this hour to talk about his collection of StoryCorps essays celebrating mothers. Before that, Emily Remick of Des Moines joins us. She created the blog BusyMommy.com, an Iowa mom blog. We'll also talk with John Murray, Associate Professor of Marketing at the University of Iowa, about all the ways companies market to moms and how they use the emotional pull of moms and the pleasant memories of childhood to market their products. A pre-Mother's Day edition of River to River after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Mothers are our focus this hour as we approach Mother's Day. Later this hour, StoryCorps founder David Isay joins us to talk about his collection of StoryCorps stories celebrating mothers called Mom. But first, the marketing of Mom. Joining us now by phone, Emily Remick of Des Moines. She's joining us. Actually, she's not. She's in our Des Moines studio. Emily, welcome to our program.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you for coming into the studio. You created a blog called BusyMommy.com, an Iowa mom blog. Tell us about it.
I did. I started in college when I had my son, and it started out as a hobby, and it's quickly turned into a business.
Okay. Tell us why you created it.
I created it because I was a new mom in college, and there weren't many other young moms in my area that were going through the same thing. So I wanted to connect with moms and kind of share my own experiences.
Okay. So if we go to your blog, what do we see?
You see a little bit of my personal life. You can see recipes, beauty and fashion tips for moms, and, you know, anything that the mom would like.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how big is your audience?
I receive about 100,000 page views a month.
And do you know anything about your audience, the demographics? Presumably mostly moms.
They are mostly moms, but I don't know any, you know, specifics.
Okay. How does your blog work as a marketing tool? How are you used by companies?
Well, right now, brands are seeking out mom bloggers. And they're doing this because moms talk. You know, before they buy a product, they look at reviews from other moms. They want to see if it's, you know, if it's affordable, if it's it does what it says it does.
Mm-hmm.
And so they want me to kind of, you know, share my experiences.
Mm-hmm. And so this is like meeting another mom in the market, in a store or something. Maybe you're looking at detergent, and it's sort of the high-tech equivalent of saying, oh, you seem to be interested in that box of detergent. Does it do what it says?
Exactly. This day and age, you know, moms have smartphones, they're on Twitter, Facebook, and so brands have to connect with them that way.
Mm-hmm. And so you do product testing for several companies. You're working with Cool Whip now?
Yes, I am a spokesperson for Cool Whip.
What do you do for them?
Well, I actually was featured in a few major magazines in one of their ad campaigns, and on my blog, I develop a few recipes for them,
mm-hmm.
and I just promote their product, and it's been great.
Mm-hmm. How are you different than someone who is paid to promote a product?
Well, sometimes I am paid to promote a product, but I disclose that.
Mm-hmm.
And then if there's, you know, a product that I just want to review because I really like it and I want to share with other moms, then they can see my honest opinion and they can read through my past 4 years of articles and, you know, get to know me and kind of, you know, my experiences and why I like this and why I don't like other things.
Mm-hmm. Aside from Cool Whip, what other companies do you work with?
Right now I'm working with Arm & Hammer, and in the past I've worked with brands like Verizon and David's Bridal, TJ Maxx, and actually Iowa Corn.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think these companies find it so desirable to work with you, to work with a mom's blog?
Well, specifically Cool Whip, I think it was because they wanted to reach out to real moms. You know, it's a lot different when there's celebrities, you know, celebrity spokespersons, because I don't think that you know, regular moms can relate to the celebrities. So they wanted to seek out mom bloggers because you know, when we appear in the magazines, they find out that we are actually a real mom, and they can go to our websites and kind of follow along on our, you know, throughout the years.
Mm-hmm. So there's it sounds like there's a trust factor. You have to make sure that you keep, you get the trust and you keep the trust.
Yeah, definitely.
How do you do that?
Just by being honest, you know, in the products, there's a lot of people that are paid to, you know, review products, and people don't know that. And, you know, people come to my website and they know when I'm getting paid, and they know when it's just something that I, you know, actually really enjoy and promote.
Mm-hmm. Can you make a lot of money doing this?
It is very hard. There is a lot of, you know, articles coming out about how mom blogging is the new thing, and you get free products. And, you know, it's taken me 4 years and a lot of hard work to get where I am. So you can't just start a mom blog and expect, you know, mm-hmm. money coming in.
Do you have competition out there?
Oh, yeah. I think there's hundreds of thousands of mom blogs in the United States and mm-hmm. more. Every day.
You balance on your blog some personal and professional items. You write about the starting of the adoption process, a very personal narrative. How does that fit in with your online image and help get companies to want you on to have you on their side?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think when I share more personal things and times in my life, then other moms can relate to those. So then in turn, then they can relate to my product reviews or, you know, my other insights on products.
Okay. And looking into the future, big plans or changes in the way you want to do things or how you see this area of marketing changing?
I see more and more brands coming to mom bloggers for big campaigns such as, you know, the Cool Whip campaign that I participated in. And, you know, just because mom bloggers are relatable to the average mom.
Okay. Emily Remick, thank you very much, of Des Moines, creator of the blog BusyMommy.com. Thank you for coming into our studio.
Thank you for having me.
And let's continue talking about the marketing of mom here as we approach Mother's Day. Joining us now, John Murray, Associate Professor of Marketing at the University of Iowa. Welcome back to our studio, John.
Thank you much. Great to be here.
Let's talk about Mother's Day and just what it means in retail terms. How big is Mother's Day?
Well, it's actually the second largest holiday spend. Only Christmas surpasses it. They estimate that about $18.6 billion are spent on Mother's Day. Average household spending is about $152. A good sign for the economy. They think that's going to be up about 13% this year.
Mm-hmm. Did Mother's Day it's been there since in all of our lifetimes, since the beginning. How did Mother's Day start? Was it a marketing tool?
No, it's another example of marketers capitalizing on an event. Mother's Day started shortly after the Civil War. A group of mothers got together to commiserate about their sons having to go to war or dying in war. And it was sort of formalized, I think, legally by Congress in the early 1910, 1915, something mm-hmm. like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now going back to Mother's Day and this enormous outpouring of spending that takes place, what are some of the categories where we spend the most on Mother's Day or for Mother's Day?
Well, the dominant ones are jewelry, almost $3 billion, about $2.5 billion in flowers. And of course, my own special one, my own favorite is just a special outing where you take mom to dinner or to some other event that she would enjoy.
Mm-hmm. And are moms spending the money too?
Moms spend money on their moms. So,
I see.
You know, so you got
everybody's got a mom connection.
Everybody's got a mom connection. That's true.
Okay. Tell us a little bit more about over the past few generations. You went back to the early 20th century. What happened in the marketing of Mother's Day as mothers began to work more and more outside the home? Did that change?
Well, I think it's more that generally how we have marketed to mothers more broadly than just Mother's Day. You know, Mother's Day is sort of a reflection of that, but it's a very special instance. You know, in general, we've seen a progression where mothers they're always recognized as being sort of the cornerstone of the family. But there's also increasingly we're trying to recognize the role of a working mother. You know, and so you'll see in advertising nowadays you'd have much more likely depictions of mothers with their children in the evenings rather than during the daytime. There's a lot of emphasis on products that allow mothers to have more quality time with their children as opposed to products, you know, being gratifying in and of themselves. And so in general, I think that the portrayals we have of mothers has changed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a good thing.
Even though working is incorporated in the marketing of mothers these days, it is still, in most cases, idealized.
Oh, very much so. And I think that actually, and there's been surveys showing that that creates stress for mothers. They start to see the way that mothers are being portrayed in advertising. About three-fourths of mothers think that they're misunderstood by advertisers. And what we see is that mothers are under extreme pressure to sort of live this idealized life. And so there was a recent ad campaign that got a little bit of a controversy with Kelly Ripa, for example, selling appliances. And there she was in her perfect hair with high heels and perfect children and, and portraying as if this is the way mothers' lives actually are.
Almost like Leave It to Beaver when we saw June Cleaver there just in her pearls and her nice dress doing the everyday things, right?
Exactly. And you know, that's not good marketing. You know, what you're showing is when you do that is that you're out of touch with the reality of all the things these mothers are balancing, you know, both professionally as well as personally. And so there's been sort of a movement back, I think, to be more realistic in how we portray mothers' roles and the important things they're doing without having to sort of stylize it in an artificial way.
Mm-hmm. John Murray is my guest, if you've just joined us, the Associate Professor of Marketing at the University of Iowa, talking about marketing and Mother's Day. Perhaps you, River to River listeners, you have a favorite mom ad that you'd like to share with us and tell us what emotions it brings out in you. Perhaps you think it's not authentic. Perhaps you think it's a great mom ad. 1-866-780-9100. RiverToRiver@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can give us a tweet at IPR Talk. Do you have any other ads that come to mind, recent ads or perhaps ads from the past that illustrate something about Mother's Day and our connections to mothers in marketing?
One of my favorite ads of all time actually showed it was for AT&T, and it showed a young soldier coming back from the Gulf War and walks up to a farmhouse that's similar to what you might see in Iowa and opens the door, and there's mom at the kitchen sink preparing a meal for him to get there, and she turns around and mom's crying, and he starts crying, and the marketing professor watching the ad starts crying, and, you know, the mothers are, you know, emotionally charged when you think about them as a symbol in all of our lives. And so, you know, we have instances where the marketers will try to leverage on that.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's other times where mothers, you know, are authoritative figures giving us approval for decisions we make, whether it's the right thing, you know, personal values, et cetera. So there's another recent ad campaign, for example, by State Farm that basically shows a mother approving of the child's decision, the young adult's decision to get insurance. And so many different ways that marketers sort of utilize the either the emotional side or the sort of authoritative or teaching side of mothers.
Mm-hmm. And are there ways in which marketers can test these ideas to see if they will work, if they're pulling the right mom strings here?
Yeah, I mean, it would be very standard to run what we call copy testing. And so typically an ad campaign would be developed by trying to understand, you know, what motivates somebody to be purchasing a product. And then you would think up different ideas based on what they start to tell you about how you might execute on that. And once you have concepts put together, you would test those with your target audience. Mm-hmm. And you know, obviously the number of times we see mothers in these ads obviously indicates their effectiveness to marketers.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Kelly Ripa in an ad before. That was, in your judgment, not good marketing. Are there any other really bad examples you can share with us that you've seen over the years?
Well, I just saw actually another one recently for American Airlines. It showed a young mom who is obviously a professional mom on the living room carpet talking with her child, and then gets on the airplane, then gets on. Next thing you see, she's on American Airlines jet taking off to go somewhere. And again, it was sort of stylized, you know, versus thinking about the kind of pressures the mom is going through as she tries to get ready to go on this trip, you know, right. And all the things that she had to arrange to take care of her family before she left. And I think what it does is advertising often deals with ideals, but it creates unrealistic expectations for mothers as to the way other people actually might really be living.
So too many mothers out there looking at that ad are saying, come on. Before going off on a trip, everyone is a little bit harried, running around thinking they forgot something and not devoting 100% of their attention to the child playing on the carpet.
Yeah, exactly. And it's the nature of advertising. You know, you typically want to always portray the positive. Mm-hmm. And hopefully mothers recognize that advertising is advertising, and it's not necessarily any statement about the quality of their own lives.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you were developing a campaign, what kind of images would you think would be more effective than the mother on the carpet before her flight playing with her child? What do you think are some good images that would be?
Well, again, what I would try to deal with are, you know, real issues that mother might, if I was American Airlines, I'd probably want to deal with real issues that mother, professional mother might face. You know, so, you know, what can American Airlines do to simplify the purchase of tickets, to make the experience of traveling easier and work more better into their lives? And so, you know, it's one thing to deal with these sort of abstract, you know, feel good kinds of symbols. It's another thing to have advertising that, you know, touches at a nerve in somebody that they can say, oh yeah, that's me. That's mm-hmm. that's what's going on in my life. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, when you get an oh, that's me reaction, that's when advertising becomes more powerful.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like their the psychology is at the root of all this.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. Can you go into a little bit of that, the underpinning there in the psychology of these ads?
Sure. The way advertising typically is thought to work is there's sort of two routes to persuasion. And one would be a very rational route. And in the rational route, we look at attributes and, you know, think about this benefit versus that benefit relative to different products. And the other route is much more of an emotional route where things non-related to the product specifically might come to bear. So, for example, if you have mothers, and there was another ad campaign like this where these bunch of celebrity figures thanking their mothers for Coca-Cola, thanking their mothers in a Coca-Cola ad, well, that has nothing to do with the quality of Coca-Cola, mm-hmm. but it makes me feel good to see these celebrities thanking their mothers. And the assumption advertisers have then is that feel good for mom gets transferred to feel good to Coca-Cola. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you might have an ad like we were talking about, the State Farm ad, where you have a mother giving a message that is correct. People should have auto insurance when they drive. Now, that's a very rational thing, and somebody might look back in and think about that. Well, you know, that is the advice my parents gave me. You know, right. I ought to be doing that. That's mm-hmm. that's part of being an adult today.
Mm-hmm. Is one more effective than the other? One approach, rational versus the indirect method?
I think the rational, typically, particularly when we talk about bigger purchases, is the where you have the greatest impact. For a lot of sort of purchases where you don't have much financial risk or personal risk or social risk, I think then a lot of the feel-good ads typically have a better chance to be effective in that domain. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just hard to come up with a lot of rational reasons why to drink Coke versus Pepsi.
Right. What about you used it just there. Is humor a good way to market to moms or use moms to market?
Humor is one of our most effective tools in general, whether we're marketing to moms or marketing a radio show host. You know, humor is a way to attract attention, create good feelings, and oftentimes also show a side to a product or a company that is more human.
Right.
And that is very important because we're all humans buying products for human needs and dealing with people and we want a good social interaction.
So instead of the mother calmly playing back to the with the child on the carpet before the flight, you might show a house that's in some disorder.
Yeah.
That people can relate to, and there might be something funny in that picture.
You could do, yeah, and it'd be more realistic. And I think you could. You have to be careful with that because you don't want your product associated with disorder and negative feelings, you know.
Right.
But on the other hand, I think that's the job of good creative people is to pull that off. And so that's why you pay ad agencies to because you want them to be able to pull that together to be relevant while also. Being humorous or adding these other dimensions to it.
Mm-hmm. So maybe in a chaotic world, this product is the one that remains constant, that you can count on.
Right.
That will not let you down in that way. Let's go back to talking a little bit more about how appeals have changed over the years from a focus on healthy meals to a focus on meals perhaps that can be prepared quickly or both.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that we've seen in early advertising, and there was a really interesting study done by some of my colleagues at the University of Nebraska, an academic study that looked into this. And one of the things, as I mentioned earlier, that they found constant across time is that mothers are simply the cornerstone. So this thing about mothers holding families together is constant. But, you know, when we early ads and going back to the 1920s, 50s showed a lot of mothers feeding their kids and the satisfaction that came from, doing a good job feeding their kids. And more recently, as you indicated, there's a greater focus here on the ease of preparation, the fact that it gives you more time to spend with your kids. And they've also just moved away from including mothers even to a greater focus just on the brands, saying this is a really good product. Selling it to the mother on that basis rather than having to have other mothers give that kind of an endorsement through the portrayal in the ad. There have been other things that I think are relevant to understand is the change in ads from sort of the traditional 1950s and 60s ads that where the mother was rewarded externally by somebody complimenting her on how her kids looked or no cavities and all the rest of that. And to today, there's a lot more ads showing mothers bringing their kids somewhere, watching them in their activities and getting sort of the inner satisfaction of seeing their kids succeed without some kind of an external reward on the quality of their motherhood.
We have just about a minute left, but what can you say about the digital age and how that's changing marketing to mothers?
Well, I got a kick out of listening to Emily. Another reason for me to listen to River to River, I learned something. You're as a marketing expert. But the digital age is affecting every aspect of marketing. And the ability to do things like what Emily's doing, where you get people closer to the market, involved in the marketing of the product, is proving to be very powerful.
Okay. John Murray, Associate Professor of Marketing at the University of Iowa. Thanks for coming in again.
My pleasure.
John. When we come back, David Isay joins us to talk about his collection of StoryCorps essays celebrating mothers called Mom. We'll be right back.
No, I would not give you false hope on the strange and mournful day. But the mother-child reunion is only a motion. Care for the life of me. Remember a Saturday. I know they say let it be. Just don't work out that way. In the course of a lifetime.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest for the remainder of the hour is StoryCorps founder and author David Isay. The New York Times bestseller titled Mom, A Celebration of Mothers from StoryCorps, which Dave Isay edited, is now available in paperback, and David Isay joins us by phone. Good afternoon to you, David.
Hi, Ben. Nice to be on the show.
Great to have you with us. Before we listen to a few examples we have lined up of StoryCorps conversations or that have to do with mothers, tell us, remind us, how StoryCorps got started.
Sure. Well, StoryCorps started about 8.5 years ago here in New York City, where I'm calling you from, and it was just this kind of crazy idea I had. I had been an NPR producer for many, many, many years before that, And I decided to try and set up a booth in Grand Central Terminal where you can bring anyone who you want to honor by listening to their story to record their story. So you could bring a mother, a grandfather, the person who you sit next to at the local diner for the past 25 years who you never had a chance to talk to.
Mm.
You come to the booth, and you're met by a facilitator who works for StoryCorps, who brings you inside. The booth is kind of this sacred space. The lights are low. It's a soundproof booth, probably not so different than where you're sitting right now. And the facilitator sits in a corner, and you sit across from your mom, say, for 40 minutes, and you talk, you ask questions. Many people think of it as, if I had 40 minutes left to live, what would I say to this person who's so important to me? What would I want to know from him or her? At the end of the 40 minutes, so they're very intense discussions. At the end of the 40 minutes, two CDs have been burned. One goes home with you for your family. The other stays with us and goes to the Library of Congress so your great-great-great-great-grandkids can someday get to know your grandmother through her voice and story. So a very simple idea that worked from the first day that we opened this in Grand Central. And since then, we've expanded across the country. We've recorded about 40,000 interviews now with about 80,000 people because people come in pairs in all 50 states. And of course, you know, NPR listeners know there's the broadcast side to this also, the stories that we air on Morning Edition every Friday morning and the books we do and now animations. And, you know, the core ideas of StoryCorps part and parcel with everything that public broadcasting stands for. It's about recognizing the dignity and grace and the stories of regular people as opposed to the kind of celebrity stuff we're fed 24 hours a day.
Right. It sort of stands on the shoulders of people like Studs Terkel in that way.
Yeah, Studs Terkel, who actually would have turned 100 next week. So he's been on my mind. Yes, yeah, Studs actually cut the ribbon on our first booth in Grand Central. He was 93 at the time, 92. And when he cut the ribbon, he said to us, you know, we know who the architect of Grand Central was, but who laid these floors, who built these walls? Those are the stories that you have to, you know, gather in this booth. And he didn't say other booths. It turned out we would have many other booths. And we've worked really, really hard ever since to live up to his mandate.
StoryCorps founder and author David Isay with us for this half hour. StoryCorps stories have a remarkable way of bringing us so much emotion, and they are actually very, very short. I want to play one example that has to do with Mother's Day. This is such a great example of how we can be getting ready for our day on a Friday morning and hear something like this. It will stop us in our tracks. Let's listen.
She was real small. She was like 5 feet 2 inches tall.
She didn't look that small.
No, but
she
was a formidable presence, and she was really defiant of authority. I remember a story when she was growing up one time of going into a classroom and the screen door behind her slamming shut, and the teacher thought she had slammed the door and made her go back and close it quietly 100 times in a row. So she closed it quietly 99 times and then slammed the hell out of it the 100th time.
So what was your relationship like with her?
We had an interesting time, especially in adolescence. We were pretty compatible up to that point, and then I think we grated on each other's nerves quite a bit. And our relationship really kind of went downhill from there. She was critical of me and very judgment-laden, and finally, when I was about 30, we were together, and it was just a miserable weekend. I felt our relationship was awful. And I told her right before I left that I couldn't deal with that kind of criticism anymore, and it wasn't helping me. And she said that that's what mothers do. And I said I didn't need a mother anymore. I needed a friend, that if she wanted to continue to try and be my mother that way, that I didn't want that. But to call me if she wanted to be my friend. She was very angry and upset, and I kind of almost didn't expect to hear from her because she could be a little stubborn. It's kind of a family trait. And I think about 2 weeks, though, after that conversation, I picked up the phone one day, and a kind of small voice said on the other side, hi, this is your friend. And it was. And we stayed friends until she died, with only occasional lapses and critical judgment. But I think I had my lapses too.
Nancy Wright talking to her son, J.D., about her mother, Frances Erickson, as a part of StoryCorps. David Isay is with us. When we listen to that, dissect it a little, if that's appropriate. David, why does it touch us so deeply in a matter of 90 seconds or 2 minutes?
Well, I actually haven't heard that story in a very, very long time. It was nice to hear it. In the last couple of months, it's been kind of this tidal wave of comments from people about how every StoryCorps story makes them cry. And, you know, most StoryCorps stories aren't actually sad. I think what the reason why people find these so affecting is that, you know, we're surrounded by so much kind of nonsense and phoniness, and this is what's going on with StoryCorps is just, it's simply an act of generosity. It's two people who come to this booth not to get rich, not to get famous, but just to connect with another human being, to tell that person that they matter to them and how much they love them by listening to their story.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think what we try and do in these stories, I was thinking about this a little bit earlier today and never thought of it quite this way, but it's almost like, you know, spinning a test tube. You know, we record obviously thousands of stories a year, and to us, every story is equally valuable, and we look at it as potentially a sacred moment in people's lives, but there are some that just have this universal quality that, you know, demand that they be listened to or be put into a book. So we spin, you know, one out of every many 400 stories rises up to the point where it may be broadcast, and then out of that 40-minute interview, it's 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes, 3 minutes spun down. So it's really the essence of the essence of this story. And to me, it's just sort of like hearing like poetry every week, I hope, for other people as well. Poetry in the voices of regular people.
You called it, I like the fact that you called it an act of generosity on the part of the listener. So you believe the person listening in that booth, even if we hear practically nothing from them, they play an important role.
Well, I don't think of StoryCorps as, despite the name, as a storytelling project. It's a listening project. They play a very, very important role. And, you know, when I built StoryCorps 8.5 years ago, it was and remains a human service project. It's about giving families the chance to have this experience, to turn off all of their electronics and focus on one another and, you know, use the microphone, which, as you know, gives you the license to have conversations you don't normally get to have. And, you know, every one of these 40,000 interviews there are surprises in there. You know, the microphone will let you find out things that you didn't know before.
Mm-hmm.
So it is very much about giving people the chance to connect in this way.
You talked a little bit earlier about the basics of how it works. I wonder if you can go into more detail. If I were to walk into a booth with, say, my mother,
mm-hmm.
You mentioned you called it a sacred space,
right.
And you also said there was a facilitator there.
That's right.
Who sits in the corner. So what directions are given to the two people who show up?
And I think that the facilitator is much more important than the sacred space. When you come to a booth, we've had hundreds of facilitators now who serve a 1-year tour of duty with StoryCorps, whose job is essentially to kind of travel the country collecting the wisdom of humanity, because that's the nature of what happens in these interviews. You show up at the booth, you make a reservation, and, you know, we at StoryCorps unfortunately can't come close to meeting the demand for these interview slots. So it's very, very hard to get a reservation when we pull into a town and open up reservations. I was in Los Angeles on book tour a couple weeks ago, and someone raised their hand and said, you know, I tried to make a reservation to get into the StoryCorps booth about 2 seconds after reservations opened, and I was number, you know, 1,400 on the waiting list. So people will usually bring someone who's extremely important to them, because it's so hard to get this slot. And then you're met by a facilitator who explains the process to you, and you give your some data about who you are. And then that person brings you into the booth, and they're there just it's a public service, to serve the family. So they'll give you some instructions and tell you how to begin the interview by saying your name and the date and your relationship with your partner. And they'll just sit there, and they call it bearing witness. And if you need help during the interview, they'll help. And if you don't, they'll stay silent.
So they don't interrupt. They only
are
there when they're needed.
That's right. And they keep logs of what happens in every interview. And afterwards, they work with you to get all the necessary data that has to go to the Library of Congress. And you may or may not sign a release after you leave the booth. If you sign the release, the interview goes to the Library of Congress. If you don't, you walk away with both copies of the CD, and there's no record that you came to the booth, which is absolutely fine with us. Mm-hmm. When StoryCorps started, I thought we'd have a compliance rate of 70, 75, 80% on signing the release, because obviously, as you know from listening, these interviews are so personal and so intimate. And since 40,000 interviews later, 8.5 years later, it's above 99.5%, that compliance rate, which speaks to how important it is to people to leave this record about their lives to go into the Library of Congress.
Right, and so many of these StoryCorps essays, conversations, bear everything. Let's listen to one. You said many of them are not sad. This one is sad. This is the story of this is Myra Dean talking to her friend Gary Jameson about her son Rich Stark, who was killed by a reckless driver in 1977.
People used to ask him what he wanted to be when he grew up, and he used to tell people he either wanted to be a marine biologist or a garbage man. He wanted to be 10, and he didn't make it. A guy had been hot rodding through our neighborhood. The car flipped over, and it landed on Rich. And all I can remember is they had pulled the driver out, and he kept saying, "Oh, my God, what have I done? What have I done?" They put me in a police car, and I just started screaming. And the ambulance driver came to me at the hospital and said, "There was nothing we could do. He's gone." And I can remember having my back to the wall, and I just slid down on my butt, leaning against the wall. And he said, "Ma'am, I'm not supposed to tell you this, but he was dead at the scene." He'll never know what that meant to me, because one of the things that was the hardest for me was, what if he was suffering and I wasn't there for him, you know? And the worst part is when you realize you're going to live, because you just want to die. I thought I wouldn't live 10 minutes, and I was astonished when I'd live 10 days and mortified when I'd live 10 months and not even grateful yet when I had lived 10 years. I was just mostly surprised. And there was no one more astonished that I'd survived it than myself. When you lose your child, it's like somebody has just amputated a huge chunk of your heart. The difference is people can't see the amputation. I miss him terribly. He was just a happy kid, and it's been a bittersweet thing that he died watching a sunset.
David, I say, what makes us want to listen to such a traumatic story? And we do want to listen to that.
Yeah, and that is as traumatic and sad and heartbreaking as any StoryCorps story we've ever broadcast. You know, I met Myra a couple of months ago on a— her story is in the book about moms, but I met her on a book tour for another book, and she came up and told me about this story being broadcast and getting hundreds of letters, and still to this day she gets letters and calls about it. But she said the night it was broadcast, she got a call from Korea, and it was a businessman who must have listened to a podcast or something, and he said, "Are you the woman from the NPR broadcast this morning?" She said, "Yeah." He said, "Yeah, well, I'm on a business trip in Korea, and I've been running around the world for the last 10 years, and I'm getting on a plane and going right home to be with my family now, and I'm quitting this job." You know, and that, you know, I think what StoryCorps does, what some of these stories do, what many of these stories do, I think is in this, you know, I in this world where we're like inundated by John Travolta's massage stories or whatever it is, you know, these force us to think about what's really important and what really matters in our lives. Again, I mean, kind of like a poem does, I guess, that it just it crystallizes life and what's important and makes you think and feel. And that's why I think that that these stories are important to listen to, and that people are willing to listen to them. You know, it's when you hear that voice and you hear a story told in that way, I mean, you're kind of walking arm in arm with Myra. You know, you can't really leave. It's again a story that kind of demands to be listened to.
In this situation, and that was one of the audio examples transcribed into the book with David Isay editing this book, now out in paperback, Mom, A Celebration of Mothers from StoryCorps. I wonder, in this situation, in this booth, David, if you find that it's often the case that participants confess that something they'd never really talked about ever before to anybody.
I think in many, 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 if not the majority of interviews, that happens. And I should say, the book isn't what we do when we do one of these books is what we try and do the same thing that we do in audio. And the audio stories don't actually translate word for word into what we believe makes a great book. So we go back to the original transcripts and we re-edit those transcripts according to the words, not the voice. So Myra's story will be somewhat different in the book. And there are many stories in this mom book of people revealing things that they had never talked about before. I think of another story of a mom and her son towards the end of the book where they're doing a StoryCorps interview very close, and he had been adopted. And she says, you know, I'm 75 years old and I've never told you this, and now's the time. And she tells him that before she had him, she had had another, she had had it before she adopted him, she had been a teenage mom and had put her own child up for adoption, and that she had just never told him but was using this opportunity to tell him. And those kind of, you know, again, I think that the safety of the space, the fact that these are really unusual conversations gives people the comfort and freedom to talk about things that they don't normally get to talk about. What doesn't ever happen in a StoryCorps booth, and what I feared would happen when we open this thing, you know, we're so attuned to like Jerry Springer and that sort of stuff and people kind of bringing out accusations from the past. That has never happened at StoryCorps. But you do see people who feel comfortable enough to talk about stuff that happened in their past, things that they had never talked about before, but not in a way to zing people or accuse people, but just as a way to find closure.
I wonder in that area if you ever have people coming in with rehearsed stories where you can see right off the bat that they've maybe rehearsed this in the front of the mirror too often, and then the facilitator has to interrupt or suggest something.
Yeah, well, we do. I mean, I actually asked. I was with a group of facilitators last week in Nashville on the mobile tour, and it's been. I'm usually locked up here in New York just raising money for StoryCorps, and it's great to get out and get to talk to them. And I actually asked them that exact question. And it's very, very rare that happens. Again, it's two people who are coming to the booth, and oftentimes it's the person who's doing the listening who is more familiar with StoryCorps than the person who's telling the story. What you will see sometimes is people coming to the booth with something that they want to read about their lives, and we will ask them to put that away and just have a conversation, because that's not... it's not an effective or powerful use of a StoryCorps. But, you know, if they insist and if that's the legacy that they want to leave, then we let them do it.
David Isay, you made freelance radio documentaries for NPR for almost 15 years before starting StoryCorps, you said 8 years ago. And now we enjoy excerpts from StoryCorps interviews broadcast on NPR every Friday morning. Will you ever return to making longer, different sort of documentaries, or is StoryCorps your mission?
Well, about a year into the project, you know, I loved making documentaries for NPR, and you know, in many ways, StoryCorps grew out of that. And you know, I think what StoryCorps is kind of documentary turned on its head, because, you know, documentaries traditionally have been about, you know, interviewing people to create a work of education or entertainment or whatever it is for a mass audience, and the benefit was to the mass audience. And I had this idea from doing these documentaries that the act of interviewing itself, that could have a positive impact on people's lives. And that became the focus on this, that it's the interviewing itself, these conversations themselves, that can have enormous public service value, and that's proved true. About a year into StoryCorps, I retired from making radio documentaries to devote the rest of my life to this thing. And we're working hard to try and turn it into a national institution that we hope will one day touch the lives of every American family and become part of the fabric of this country. We have a long, long, long way to go, but that's where my focus is. It would be great someday to be able to have more time to spend with the StoryCorps content, the recordings that come in. And someday I hope to be able to do that. But for the time being, It's institution building and fundraising here, which is great. You know, when you believe in something completely, I mean, to me, this is, you know, this is my calling. So it's a great privilege to be able to do this every day.
Remind us how we can find StoryCorps on the web, David.
Sure. It's StoryCorps.org. And this book, the Mom book, and every other book that we put out, 100% of the profits go back to StoryCorps so we can serve more people across the country with this public service.
StoryCorps founder and author David Isay, the New York Times bestseller titled Mom, A Celebration of Mothers from StoryCorps, is now available in paperback. David Isay, thank you for taking time to step into our booth.
It's my pleasure, Ben. This is really fun. Thank you so much.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
River to River is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Des Moines, we had help from Jonathan Aul. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River available at iowapublicradio.org. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Want to love you and give you the world. Now you find that you've been misused. Talk to me, I'll do what you choose. I want you to.